Buckaloo, who has spent some special time over the last couple of weeks crunching data specifically for Jefferson County and the environs. Dr. Buckaloo comes to us after having retired a 45-year career, ending up at Redstone Arsenal as a very senior civil servant, and she has brought her deep analytical skills to the league and helped form a new league in the Tennessee Valley, and is now serving on the League of Women Voters of Alabama State Board. So she is gracious enough to give us a briefing that was previously done at a state league meeting, but in greater depth and with specific data for Jefferson County. So we want to thank Dr. Buckaloo for doing this for us, and there will be time after her presentation for questions from our participants. Dr. Buckaloo.
She's going to have to unmute.
I think I did.
You're still muted. Yeah. Robin, there we go.
I said, thanks very much for giving me this opportunity, and could somebody bring the briefing up? Okay, great. So in the 2018 general election, Alabama voters were about 40.1% Democrat and about 59.9% Republican. However, 72% of state legislative seats went to Republicans and 85% of congressional seats went to Republicans. How did this happen? It happened due to a legislative district building technique commonly referred to as gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is named after an early governor of Massachusetts, Elbridge Gerry, who devised a very strange looking district to advantage his own political party. The district resembled a salamander and so earned the nickname gerrymander from Gerry's name. The news media of the time added the wings and the wicked looking head, but basically the shape is exactly what Gerry devised. Okay, could I get the next chart? What is gerrymandering? It's a technique to draw legislative districts in such a way as to maximize the number of districts that have a voting majority of one party. This is done by cracking and packing. Cracking is the division of an area containing a concentration of voters of the victimized party, so that pieces of that area are distributed into districts safe for the controlling party. Packing is the creation of districts that contain as many voters of the victimized party as possible in order to minimize their ability to influence outcomes in other districts. Back one chart. Here we are. This is the chart I want to talk about. Okay, so in the hypothetical example with 50 voters, 30 blue and 20 red, if party blue is controlling the districting or redistricting process, you might end up with 5 districts, each of which has 6 party blue voters and 4 party red voters. Party blue would control all the districts. The picture also shows other examples of redistricting strategies, one equitable and one advantaging party red. In this last one, blue voters are packed into 2 overwhelmingly blue majority districts so that red voters can outnumber the remaining blue voters in the other 3. There are constraints on this process. In Alabama and in most other states, an approximately equal number of people must live in each district, and a district must be contiguous. It can't be divided into more than one separate piece. Most states also mandate that a district be quote, compact, unquote, to minimize the distance between any two points in it, and that it respect geographical and political communities of interest. In practice, these constraints, not precisely defined, are often flouted, and certainly they're flouted in Alabama. The U.S. Supreme Court has also ruled that racial gerrymandering is not allowable, that is, redistricting to minimize the influence of, say, African-American people in Alabama is illegal. Okay, yes. So this chart shows you how redistricting is done in Alabama. It's the responsibility of the state legislature. The legislature has a standing committee on redistricting called the Permanent Legislative Committee on Reapportionment. Note that I said permanent. It meets all the time. It includes members of both houses, three each, appointed by the Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker of the House, respectively. During the redistricting following each U.S. Census, the committee expands. It then includes a member of the House from each congressional district, a member of the Senate from each congressional district, and four members from each House appointed by the Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker of the House, respectively. The committee is to make a continuous study of the reapportionment problems in Alabama, quote unquote. It reports to the legislature whenever it deems necessary. The legislature votes on the redistricting plan, which is then signed or vetoed by the governor. Okay, next chart. This is, of course, Alabama's seven congressional districts, and in a little bit, I'll be talking to you about the sixth district, which is the district that Leonette Slay said that most of you would be interested in. The practical effect of the contiguity constraint in Alabama is that in areas of highly concentrated Democratic voters, like the Black Belt in South Alabama, there are districts packed with Democrats. It is not possible to crack up these areas and assign them to safe Republican districts. In urban areas such as Western Madison and Eastern Limestone counties, where I live, it's easier to crack an area demographically Democratic and assign pieces of it to surrounding Republican areas so that most districts end up reliably Republican. Alabama uses a very tight equal population constraint, plus or minus 1%, in order to justify non-compactness and breaking up geographical and political communities of interest. If you look at the Alabama congressional districts below, you note the 2nd, 6th, and 7th districts, especially how the 7th snakes through Birmingham, which is what we'll be talking about later. The 7th district is the only one in Alabama represented by a Democrat, and she was unopposed in the last election, which is not surprising since most of the Democrats in Alabama were packed into her district. It wouldn't have made any sense for a Republican to run against her. This district is surrounded by safely Republican districts. Next chart. League of Women Voters, Tennessee Valley, has done a detailed analysis of Alabama State Senate District 2. And I'm gonna sort of skip over this part. But basically, in Madison County, we have 93 precincts, and there are only two of them that are not split. That is, people in a precinct, depending on where they live in the precinct, vote for different candidates, different state Senate representatives, different county commissioners, different state House representatives. And this is done in order to prevent Madison County from having any Democratic state senators and to minimize the number of state representatives. So this example here, if you work through the chart, it just basically shows how precincts were split, Democratic votes were pulled out and put somewhere else, and then limestone precincts were pulled in to replace those votes with Republican votes, so that by straddling the Madison limestone county line with the district, it was possible to allow a Republican to win, although actually not by a great majority.
Okay. Robin, may I interrupt for just a minute? Would everyone please be sure to mute yourselves, please, in the probably the lower left-hand corner of the screen, or if you're on an iPad in the upper, I believe the upper right. Is that right, Leonette? I'm getting a little background noise. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, I have unmuted myself, and I can tell there are several people who have not muted their device. So those of you enjoying beverages and those of you who are taking notes, please note that you need to mute. Thank you.
Okay, let's look at the next chart. This chart is one precinct in Madison County, and it shows that the precinct has votes in several different districts. So you can see the yellow part is in District 2. You can see that down in the right-hand bottom corner, there are District 7 votes. And this is pretty typical for a lot of the precincts in Madison County. Now, in Birmingham, you don't have as many split precincts, and I'll show those to you in a minute. And I think that the purpose of precinct splitting in Birmingham must have been different from that in Madison County. I don't have a precinct map of Birmingham, so I had to rely on the street addresses of the precinct headquarters, which sometimes are in the middle of the precinct and sometimes they're not anywhere near the middle of the precinct. But you'll see the pattern nonetheless. So now I'd like to talk about that analysis. And prior to 1992, the 6th district, the 6th congressional district, encompassed all of Birmingham and Jefferson County. Jefferson County as a in the 2018 election, Walt Maddox received 152,103 votes, and I apologize for my grandfather clock. Kay Ivey received 105,661. The Democratic margin for lieutenant governor was not much different. Depending upon which source you consult, Jefferson County has a population of around 659,000. The population of Alabama is about 4.9 million. 1/7 of that, the ideal congressional district size, is about 700,000 people. So Jefferson County, all by itself, is very close to the size of a district. So now if you look at this chart and then look at, you can see where the 7th district snakes in and makes your 6th district look like a hammerhead shark, as Jane Johnson likes to say. So look at the next chart. We're going to zero in on this next chart. You can see the top of that white part, which is the 7th district eating into the 6th district. What I'm going to do is show you different precincts that are in the 6th district, in that 7th district tail in there that creates the neck of the hammerhead, and then on the district line. Next chart. Okay, this is a map of that part of Birmingham. If you look at the yellow line that is snaking around there, that's highlighted, that line is what you were just looking at, that is the 7th district snaking in and making your district into a hammerhead. If you look at the pink stickies on the outside of that yellow highlighted line, those are typical precincts that are in the 6th district. Those precincts are solidly Republican. If you look at the green stickies are split precincts. Part of those votes go to the 6th district and part of them go to the 7th district. For the most part, the precincts that I've found in this particular area, whether they're split or 7th district, are pretty much Democratic. If you look at the orange stickies, the orange stickies are headquarters of precincts that are completely within the 7th district. What happened here is that 90,000 Democratic votes got pulled out of this area and stuffed into the 7th congressional district, leaving what was left of Birmingham to combine with four solidly much more rural counties, Bibb, Chilton, Coosa, and then your suburban Birmingham County of Shelby. And so that district is now a solidly Republican district, in spite of the fact that historically Jefferson County should have been its own congressional district and was, and has plenty of votes to fill up a district. So I'd like to stop right at this point because I'm going to move on to some other Fair Maps topics, but I wanted to see if anybody wanted to ask some questions. Okay, I'm going to take that as a no. Please. Okay, power mapping. Okay, so.
Folks, please unmute. Remember to unmute yourselves if you would like to address a question to Robin.
Well, Robin, this might be a good time for you to share what you think the future might be if more than one Lee collaborated on this subject to see if we could bring some higher attention to this as we move into the 2020 census aftermath next year. What is your assessment of what has been going on in North Alabama?
I don't have much hope except at the federal level. And I was going to get into that in the next part of the charts. Because the Fair Maps campaign was set up to have different initiatives in different states to try to push the For the People Act, which would mandate nonpartisan redistricting commissions in all the states that don't have them. Some states have initiative and referendum, like, for example, Florida. And those states were encouraged to circulate citizen petitions and get something on their ballot. Some states have divided legislatures or a favorable governor, and those states were encouraged to lobby their state legislatures to change the law. Doesn't have any of that. The hope for Alabama is to get, tell me if you can't hear me because it says my internet connection is unstable. The hope for Alabama is to push federal legislation. The federal legislation that is relevant is House Rule 1, which is the For the People Act, which passed the House last year in March, I believe, of 2019. And then the Voting Rights Advancement Act, which was introduced in the House by Terry Sewell and passed the House in December. The Voting Rights in Advancement.
Can I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Are there any states where Democrats have been as egregious as in their gerrymandering as Republicans are here in Alabama?
Maryland.
Okay, so it's, thank you.
In fact, in the past, there were often states where Democrats were as egregious. In Virginia, there was a near miss recently because they flipped their legislature and they had campaigned on fixing the system of redistricting so it was nonpartisan. And then when the new Democratic legislature came in, they were strongly tempted not to do that. And the League of Women Voters, presidents of 13 states, including Alabama, sent a letter at the request of the Virginia League that basically said, we're watching you and what you're doing for or against democracy. And I think the danger passed. I think that that's okay now. But yeah, either party would do that. And the other bad thing is that if you look at, say, Alabama, the Democratic representatives are pulled into the conspiracy because it makes their seats safe also. So if a person is more motivated by holding on to his or her own seat rather than seeing that all the seats are equitably distributed, then partisan redistricting has got a lock on the legislature. We had Senator Arthur Orrin to speak to the League of Women Voters Tennessee Valley last year, and we asked him point blank about the redistricting, and he was really quite smug about it. He said that the legislators like it that way, and they're not really inclined to do anything to change it. We ask him point blank, how do you feel about the legislators picking their voters instead of the voters picking the legislators? I will note that he left pretty fast at the end of his speech. He wasn't really interested in hanging around. Okay, so if we could go to the power mapping chart. Can we bring that chart up? Okay, it'll be the next chart after that. Okay, great. So I told you that the League of Women Voters started the Fair Maps campaign, and that Alabama went into the basket of people that are trying to push federal legislation. At a workshop in October near Washington in 2019, the League of Women Voters U.S. described the campaign and led discussions on how to build coalitions to influence change. Two key subjects that really interested me were power mapping and storytelling. Power mapping is an activity that identifies groups and individuals that can influence the outcome of an issue of interest. Power mapping works best in a brainstorming scenario. The group in question is plotted on axes quantifying the extent of the group's influence versus the current position of the group on that issue. For example, the NRA has enormous influence on gun control legislation, and its position is far away from that of the League. So in the chart below, if you were going to plot it, it would be plotted in the far upper right corner. The next step in power mapping, after all individuals and groups of interest have been plotted, is to assess whether to devote resources to them to draw them into a coalition. To use the NRA example, probably the decision would be not to, since the odds of moving their position would be low. But if you plotted a group like the American Medical Association, there could be some potential to develop it as an ally. Other groups, perhaps the AAUW, might be so aligned that no additional resources are necessary. The end result of a power mapping activity should be a list of groups and individuals to focus on when trying to build a coalition. In other words, how do you allocate your resources? Next chart. Storytelling is a powerful activity to persuade groups and individuals to become allies. The story is basically an anecdote about a problem that exists for a real person that would be resolved by correcting the issue at hand. And if you go to the next chart, the example in the workshop was Jimmy Kimmel's story about his infant son born with a terrible heart problem and having open heart surgery at 3 days old. He told his story on live TV in support of the Affordable Care Act, and it resonated with millions of people. He said, if your baby is going to die, and it doesn't have to, it shouldn't matter how much money you make. I think that's something that whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or something else, we can all agree on. The workshop itself offered a story connected with gerrymandering. In 1992, the riots in Los Angeles took a heavy toll on many neighborhoods, including the area known as Koreatown. It's estimated that the city suffered damages of more than $1 billion, much of it concentrated on businesses operated by Koreans and other Asian immigrants. When residents of these neighborhoods appealed to their local officials for assistance with the cleanup and recovery effort, however, each of their purported representatives, members of the city council and the state assembly, passed the buck, claiming that the area was part of another official's district. This was because new district lines drawn after the 1990 census fractured Koreatown. Koreatown, barely over 1 mile square, was split into four city council districts and five state assembly districts. And because Asian Americans did not make up a significant portion of any official's constituency, officials were left with little incentive to respond to the Asian American community. But here's the story reframed as a storytelling story with a real person, a real problem, and a twist. Johnny Kim owned a restaurant in Koreatown. He was born and raised in California, but he took enormous pride in putting his grandmother's kimchi stew and fish cakes on the tables for the 100-plus customers he served on an average day. His father had opened the restaurant 20 years earlier, and his daughter had recently expressed interest in taking over the restaurant as his retirement drew near. On April 29, 1992, his hope for the future changed dramatically. I thought that was really neat. It puts a human face on gerrymandering and the effect that it has on people. The story has a goal to advance for the person who tells it. It establishes an emotional connection between the story and the audience. In Kimmel's case, parents of children. It has a main character, Baby Billy. It has a challenge, defeating efforts to kill affordable care. And the Army will be surprised to hear that many children will be denied medical care they need to stay alive if the law is killed. The desired outcome is to preserve affordable care in order to save the lives of children. We need stories to support fair redistricting in Alabama. Alabama stories would touch the federal legislature, not just people in Alabama. I think, for example, there's a story to tell about Medicaid expansion. Our state is practically dead last in maternal mortality and infant mortality. So that's sort of my challenge. Is there something that you can use out of this briefing to help us tell a story and push the end of partisan gerrymandering? And I'm sorry, I can't talk for an hour. You would not be able to hear me if I tried to talk for an hour, but I would be happy to take any questions that you might have about any part of this briefing.
Folks, be sure to unmute yourselves, please.
This is Leonette. I was remiss in not recognizing that we have our state president on this meeting agenda. And so from a statewide perspective, both you and Barbara Caudill, our president, have a wider view than we do in Birmingham. So what I think I'm hearing is that we should be directing more of our efforts to the federal level than the state level, or did I misinterpret that?
We've been encouraged to lobby the senators to pass the VRAA. That is the immediate goal of is longer term. It's supposed to last another 2 years. We had a postcard campaign. So far we've sent about 385 postcards to Senator Shelby expressing the different people's opinions on why the VRAA ought to be passed, and those postcards all have League of Women Voters logos on them. So he should know by now that we're out there agitating.
Okay, let me ask one other question. We have some states that actually do have nonpartisan commissions California being one, and I think Oregon has it on their ballot this year. So what's their history been with going to a nonpartisan commission and redistricting?
The best one that I heard was, I think it was Oregon. Anyway, looking at the states that have done it, that have had it in place for several years, it seems to be working very well. And the interesting thing is that, for example, there was a vote in Texas last year. The legislature doesn't want nonpartisan redistricting, but both Republicans and Democrats in the state voted in favor of it. It seems that the corrupting effect that this has on various legislatures doesn't necessarily extend to the electorate.
Robin, this is Jean. When do you think the legislature will go about the process of redistricting? Will it be, I guess it will have to be in the next legislative session, correct?
My internet went down. Can you repeat that question?
I was just interested to know when you think this redistricting will actually take place.
I'm trying to find out. I asked Laura Hall because she's a local representative out of Huntsville and she's on the redistricting committee. And she has not been able to find that they have any plans. They will be late. The census data is not coming in until after, by statute, Alabama is supposed to complete its redistricting. But the legislature apparently has not addressed that yet. She was trying to find out for me, and she's on the committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, one of my dreams as state president, this is Barbara, is to begin to have an observer corps that can go and attend meetings of agencies like the Public Service Commission or the Redistricting Commission. The problem is that they are not transparent and it's hard to find out when they actually meet, when they are meeting. And I don't know whether it would be worthwhile to write to the governor to ask her to include in a session call a requirement that we change the statute and bump the acquisition of census data in an emergency to make it congruent with the legislative session. I don't know what a good strategy would be. I've toyed with both of them, with the Observer Corps and with asking her to put something in the session call, because it's clear they're going to have a special session to address at least the budget. And we've got some other things that we'd like to see them do, and it might be a good time to write to her and ask her to put them in.
Well, the good part about doing that, whether the legislature did anything or not, is that number one, they would know that somebody was aware that this was an issue. And number two, you could release the letter to some of the more favorable columnists and get some publicity on the issue. I don't think most people are even aware that this is happening.
We've got so many different things going on. I feel like I've got plates spinning at the end of every finger.
Yeah.
It's exciting, but it's things drop between the cracks, and that's dropped out of my view recently, and I apologize. And I wanted to ask, go ahead.
This is Lynette again. Do you think we're going to lose a district next year, a congressional district, and how is that going to play out in the commission's work?
I suspect that we are, unless the census undercounts some of the faster growing states. I, you know, I really can't predict what the response is going to be, especially with COVID going on. But if everybody got counted equally, I suspect that we would lose a seat. And that is going to be really interesting, because I don't squeeze the Democratic voters any more than they've already been squeezed.
And it would make, one would think that that pressure would create some energy around bumping back some of the redistricting deadlines. But we're not talking about rationality.
No, we're talking about people in the legislature who want to hold on to their seats being in charge of drawing the district lines.
Okay, well, I don't want to make this any longer unless you have questions. I've already had a question about the slides and whether they'll be available, and the answer is yes, they will. We'll send you information about how you can access those.
I have an offer today. This speech is written. I can send you, if you like, I can send you this version, and you can make it available to anybody that's interested in looking at it.
Very good. Thank you.
And Leonette, do you know, I mean, not Leonette, I'm sorry. Robin, you might want to talk to them also about the VRAA grant that provides an opportunity for local aides.
Okay, well, I had hoped that everybody had seen that, but out of the VRAA grant that we got from National, Carol, Barbara, what's your last name? It slipped my mind. Prickett sent out an email from me that solicited proposals from local leagues on the order of around $300 if you have a proposal in a local league that might be a good idea on your part to push the VRAA. And I said that I needed the proposals by the end of July, and that we needed to execute them by the 1st of October if they're to be effective, you know, in pushing federal legislation before the end of this Congress. But I thought there might be some really good ideas out there that I had, you know, had no idea about. So I was interested in making several awards on that order of money.
And we're also going to be doing a digital ad campaign. We spent the afternoon talking to the developer that's going to produce the digital ad, a very short ad, explaining something that concrete that people can do to restore some of the protections of the Voting Rights Act.
And Barbara, yeah. We have a question from an attendee about the lawsuit that the league at state level has filed. Can you share that information and what's on the horizon?
Well, we're very excited to have filed a lawsuit. Believe it or not, as much as we have complained about the Alabama Constitution, it has explicit language in it protecting people's right to vote in times of tumult. And if the pandemic doesn't constitute tumult, nothing does. So we have filed a lawsuit in state court, which is a little unusual. Most lawsuits about voting rights are filed in federal court because they conjure up the Voting Rights Act. But our lawsuit is filed in state court using a dream team of lawyers. Two past presidents of the Alabama Bar Association are among our legal team. and they have asked for some tweaks to protect the safety of all Alabama citizens, because we know that when COVID strikes, it strikes across the board. And when one of us is damaged, all of us are damaged. So we have filed a lawsuit asking for some, what we think are common sense solutions, because the Secretary of State and the governor during times of emergency have extraordinary powers to modify rules and regulations and laws. So we have asked them to modify the absentee ballot provisions to make sure that people who choose to vote in person are adequately protected and feel safe. We ask for things like removing some of the witness requirements for absentee ballots, removing some of the requirement of a provision of a voter ID copy, because that's hard to do if you are sheltering in place and you don't happen to have a copier or a printer at home. We also asked for things like to require that they have curbside voting. If we can do curbside COVID testing with where you don't have to get out of your car and you can be tested, why can we not modify some polling places so that people who don't want to get out of their cars but who still want to feel like they're casting a ballot can drive up and vote in that way without getting out of their cars. We've asked for early voting, even though we know the Secretary of State thinks that that's crazy. Because if you have several different days that you could vote on, you don't have everybody piled up into a crowded church basement on voting day. So these are not huge leaps. These are minor, relatively minor tweaks to the system to improve the voting experience for all Alabamians. Now, tomorrow, I will tell you, we have requested a court order ordering these things to happen. And the hearing on the preliminary injunction is tomorrow at 10. So our lawyers will need some good thoughts and prayers sent their way that they can be persuasive enough to get a judge on our side to enact these requirements. Because we feel that we have medical testimony to the effect that the COVID virus is going to be with us for another year. And so right now, the tweaks that have been discussed have only been discussed for the July 14th primary runoff. And we know there are some municipal elections in August. There are some special legislative elections. And that the nothing said about how people are going to vote in those. And then, of course, we have the jackpot in November. So we want these tweaks, these modifications to extend through this election cycle, which we'll just see. Because, as you know, there was a federal lawsuit filed before we filed ours in state court. And the judge has ordered some things in the federal lawsuit, which are very confusing. He's indicated that it only applies to his order only applies to three counties. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And the Secretary of State has appealed that confusing ruling. And we, you know, for all we know, the day before the election, the judge could hand something down. So it's all very interesting, and I'm sorry to go on and on. It's just something I feel very strongly about. But you should be proud of your state board. Are there other? I hope I answered the question.
Leonette, this is Nancy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the chat works for me and sometimes it doesn't. And perhaps it's just as well I attempt to state it. It is not a question, but it's simply that I think probably everyone on this call and many of us would simply like, I certainly would like to confirm the number of real life stories that Alabama Arise has been able to collect and is always looking for more in terms of how Medicaid expansion could save lives. And I think there was a reference recently by someone that at least one of those stories many of us have heard. And I hope that any of us who know such stories will continue to share them through Alabama Arise as perhaps the best way to make those possible. Thank you.
And just to follow up on what Nancy said, as a reminder, the State League is a coalition partner of Alabama Arise, since we have so many principles in common. So thank you for that, Nancy. We have captured a number of comments in the chat room, and so we will be looking at those and responding, and just real pleased at the wide array of participants that we've had tonight. I see some brand new members. I see some more experienced members. I see some non-members. So thank you for joining us. A huge thank you to Dr. Buckaloo, who I kind of just asked her to do this back a long time ago, and then she just took it and ran with it. And we are all the better for it, and we will be talking about this for a long time. And it's always a pleasure to have our state president with us, because she can share the latest that is going on from a very active state board. And we are about to enter the national convention caucuses and convention itself. So we will have lots to report over the next few days. So if there are no other comments, I do want to thank I want to thank Jean Johnson for being our social media maven and making all this happen. Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Hi, this is June, not Jack.
Yes.
I'm eating dinner. I would like to ask if there's some way that we could see what is in that lawsuit. Can we get I don't know how that would work, but I'm interested in the individual points that Barbara pointed out were being asked for the court to look at.
Jean, this is Amy. Do you still have that document that you sent out that had you know, all the points, the whole case,
yes,
still give out? Because that was so compelling.
Actually, yes, that would be kind of what I'd be looking for.
It is linked from our website, and we have posted it. I believe we've linked it from a Facebook post, but that may have run, you know, down off your viewing area substantially, but I'm quite sure it is still on the website. I will check to make sure that it is.
Okay, that'd be great.
I can link to it from there.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
It'd be interesting.
Okay,
time reading. It's sort of dry and long, but we're delighted and flattered that you are interested in reading it, because I think it's very powerful. It's very well written.
Yeah, I think it would be very powerful, this kind of thing that, you know, my brain can absorb a little bit better than some of the other things. So
that website address, by the way, is lwval.org. It's on the state website.
Okay.
Thank you. I would like to leave you all with a teaser for our August meeting. We've got special permission from the Alabama Bar to show their marvelous documentary on suffrage. Woo-hoo. With an emphasis on what was going on in Alabama during this important period, with August, of course, being the pivotal month when Tennessee ratified the 19th Amendment and therefore it was set to be entered into the Constitution. So we'll be sending more details about that. It will be a Zoom meeting unless something changes dramatically, and we don't see that happening. So we will tell you, and let me say that this is a wonderful documentary and you will enjoy it, I am sure, in August. We will not be having a monthly meeting in July.
Can Yvonne give us a plug for the archives program this week? And suffrage?
I'm sorry, Barbara. I'm sorry, who said that?
Mary Lynn.
I'm sorry, repeat your question. Mary Lynn, I think you're muted.
The archives is having a special program on suffrage. I wondered if you wanted to put in a plug for it, since you work with the archives.
Oh, well, of course, I haven't been down there in over 3 months. So I know it's on my calendar. I don't quite remember the date. But
Thursday.
Yeah, they're showing a preview of something that's going to be on PBS. I haven't seen it, so... You know, I don't really know the details, but, you know, they've been doing a lot of work, of course, with women's history, and a lot of the work has been delayed until next year. But so, yeah, it's going to be a surprise to me. Usually I'm kind of more in the loop, but, you know, having not been down there, I don't really know.
On my calendar, I put down that it's this Thursday, the 25th at 7 o'clock. It's called The Vote.
Right.
Is that what we're talking about?
I think so, yes. It may encompass some of the information that will be in their gallery display that should have opened back in March. I'm guessing here. It could be some profiles of different women from Alabama that played an important part in the suffrage movement. We'll find out.
We did put that on Facebook, but you know, not everybody is on Facebook, so maybe we should post that on the on the state and the Birmingham website. That you can link to it. We'll see that.
Thank you for reminding me about that, Mary Lynn. I know it's on my calendar, but I hadn't thought about it in a few days, so I am looking forward to it.
Is this something that we can watch virtually?
Yes. I assume it's a Zoom. I do have the invitation, but yes, it will be some sort of online venue. And then the entire program will be on Alabama Public Television. Let me look and see if I can find out when that is.
It's part of the PBS series, The American Experience.
Okay. I don't see the email right now the archives sent out, but Mary Lynn, I'll try to find out some more information and send it to you offline.
Okay, any other comments or questions or concerns? Well, once again, thank you for joining us tonight. Big thank you to Dr. Buckaloo and Barbara Caudill and Jean Johnson. Everyone have a very pleasant evening and defend democracy.
Good night.